Huh? I have no idea.
It doesn't
appear to be. I mean, if anybody knows how to do this. Yeah. Okay. So, I just need a 25-year-old up here is what I need. Okay, but you can hear me okay, is that right? You sure? Okay, all right, so I'll try to remember to holler at you. We're all at the age where we're hollering at each other all the time. And I realize that there are those of you who will hear about one-third of what I have said, and I assume that there is divine purpose in that. So, okay, so you've got me for the next four Sundays, and I'm going to be teaching on Matthew 17:22 to 18:34, or more or less. And this is the teaching of Jesus to his disciples when they gathered for the last time at Capernaum in Galilee, which is where Jesus lived, after the transfiguration and before leaving for Jerusalem and death and resurrection. And there it is, the following stories: the miracle of the coin in the fish's mouth, the millstone around the neck causing little ones to stumble, the gouge out your right eye and cut off your right hand if they cause you to sin, the 90 and 9 story with sheep, what you're supposed to do before you can clobber people in your church for doing things, forgiving 70 times 7, and what happens to unforgiving people. Those stories are in there. And today we're going to talk about the coin in the fish's mouth, mostly. But I could be wrong, but I think all these stories are connected, because that's how Christ delivered them. He delivered his disciples, and that's how Matthew recounts them as a single discourse that's given in one place at one time. So since I'm not Christ, and you aren't going to sit here long enough, well, it's going to take me at least four Sundays to tie these all together, if I ever do. And the main reason we have to take four Sundays to do this is because we aren't Jewish, living at the time of the Second Temple in Jerusalem. We're not Second Temple Jews. So we have to take the long way around. Well, first of all, to get all these stories, we need to introduce you to Matthew, because he is the one telling the stories. Matthew is the resident legal and tax expert of Christ's inner circle of disciples. And Mark and Luke refer to him as Levi, son of Alphaeus, which is why we can make an educated guess that Matthew was born a Levite, meaning he started out burdened by expectations, and he had a generational assignment to the priesthood. But Matthew, the apostle, in his gospel, refers to himself only as the tax collector. None of this other, because that's what he was doing when Christ called him. So he would have prepared to be a priest from his earliest days. He'd been schooled in the Mosaic law. He would more likely than any of the other disciples. But then he broke bad. He became a tax collector, meaning he defected to the Romans, because the Romans were the ones who collected taxes. So Matthew went over the dark side. He did a Darth Vader. Now, if that's right, then Matthew couldn't have gotten any further from his upbringing than where he ended up. So I'm just curious if you happen to know of anybody like that. How are you relating to them? If they're in your circle, they could be a Matthew. You could be a Matthew. What does Christ do with people like Matthew? Well, Matthew and Luke both tell us how Christ called Matthew to discipleship right out of the blue by inviting Matthew and his reprobate friends to dinner at Matthew's house. And by the way, Matthew's buying. So, Fran and I have had the privilege of getting to know some Vatican folks our last couple visits to Rome, and I can tell you that Catholic priests never buy. If you take them to dinner, you will buy. So just be prepared. And they're going to take you someplace that is not going to be cheap. And you'll love it, but you will buy. So I think of this, Christ going up and telling Matthew, hey, we're going to dinner and you're buying. So anyway, what are you having for dinner tonight? So this is about Christ managing his disciples' expectations. And any story about Christ discipling the 12 is giving us an example of how to disciple others as he told us to. So Christ has gathered his disciples in his home in Capernaum to give them a heads up as to what's about to happen to him and to them. And the bottom line is Christ is managing people's expectations, and he's telling them redemption is coming. My kingdom is coming. And in fact, it's here. And all the things you ever wondered about are going to be put right. But he says, first, I have to die. Which is not what they wanted to hear at all. And that is creating problems among the disciples when it sinks in that Christ is not meeting their expectations. So we're going to consider Matthew 7:22-18:24 from the point of view of Second Temple Judaism, expectations of Messiah. So the Second Temple relates to Messiah and relates to the Second Coming. The Second Temple Judaism is the Jewish religion as it developed during the Second Temple period. It began with the construction of the Second Temple around 516 BC, and it ended with the Roman siege of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. And that was really the third temple, because the temple was around at the time of Christ, was built by Herod. But this is really more about a mindset, Second Temple mindset. So remember last year, I talked right about this time, and we focused on a courtroom scene in Isaiah 41. And the legal case that the exiles returning from Babylon would have brought against the king, who is Yahweh. So basically, it was that God didn't do what they expected. So Cyrus the Persian had defeated Babylon, the sworn enemy of the Jews, but he doesn't visit destruction upon them as the Babylonians did. So Jews had received their double punishment for sin. They thought now it was Babylon's turn. The earnest desire of the Jews was for the downfall of the Chaldean kingdom. That was fulfilled, but the outcome was not what they expected. The political power of the Babylonians was broken, but no vengeance had followed upon them. Instead of being ruthlessly destroyed, like Babylonians did to Jerusalem, Babylon remained in the city, remained intact, and became the splendid winter residence of Cyrus the Persian king. And most important to their expectations was there was no visible, universal, messianic kingdom. Just another more powerful pagan empire had taken the place of the one that was overthrown. So the faith of Jews from exile returned to Jerusalem to build a second temple, expecting the world dominion of their God, was now shaken. So they were still living in that space at the time of Christ with the Romans in charge. So Second Temple Judaism is where the idea of end times gets its start. And the Jews at the time of Christ, including and especially the disciples themselves, get their expectations of Messiah. So around the time Solomon's temple was destroyed, and then it was rebuilt 70 years later as the Second Temple, Isaiah and Ezekiel and Haggai and Zechariah prophesied a future king who would rule a purified Israel as God's representative, the Messiah. And sometimes appears to be maybe two Messiahs, a suffering servant and a second one fulfilling the messianic role of a ruling king. This is normal in Judaism before Christ. And for some Jews, it still is. They're still waiting on that. Modern evangelicals, which I assume you all probably are, you and I, me both, we have something special in common with Second Temple Jews. And that is a fixation on the Second Coming. Everything's going to get put right. And if you're a rapture believer, then you know that Christ is going to show up with a big bus, and he's going to put people in a big bus while the world is burning down around them, and they get on the bus, and then they're going to go away. So, but that would be very Second Temple. So the disciples get stressed. And by the way, here's a commercial. Young people are becoming hopeless about the future, the next generation. They don't want to have children. Many of them don't really care about careers. They or appear not to. They're about living in the moment. They're about experiences, because they've been told among other things, that the world is going to burn up. It's going to burn up to a cinder. That is that there is really no future. And if Christians are reflecting the same thing, that, just Christ is going to show up and it's all going to burn up in a cinder. Well, where do you think they got that? So just a commercial about preaching and thinking and speaking hope to people who have made up their mind that there soon will be nothing left to follow. Okay, so the disciples get stressed. Matthew 17:22, they were gathering and out at Galilee. Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day." And they were greatly distressed. So Jesus says many things that greatly distress his disciples. And why does Matthew single out this one? Well, Christ speaks of himself as Son of Man in this, as he's speaking to them. That identifies him clearly as Messiah. And it ties back to the Old Testament prophecies of Ezekiel, Isaiah, and Zechariah, which these guys knew intimately. He didn't have to repeat it to them like we have to repeat it to ourselves. So he tells his disciples he's about to be delivered into the hands of men who will kill him. And this is the crisis of expectations of Second Temple Judaism. He tells them also he's going to be raised on the third day, but that's just too much for them to digest. And particularly because in Scripture, in Old Testament Scripture, all kinds of important things tend to happen on the third day. So it's fraught to talk about the third day. Stars are created on the third day. Abraham gets his first glimpse of the promised land on the third day. Israel reaches Mount Sinai on the third day after leaving Egypt. Sacrificial meal must be eaten no later than the third day. Hezekiah gets a sign of healing from God on the third day. Esther waits 3 days before going to King Ahasuerus. All sorts of consequential things. All the more reason for the disciples to be distressed. Okay, so now we get to the miracle of the temple tax and the fish. And that starts with verse 24, Matthew 17. I think this one's a lot of fun. Because you kind of skip over. It's like, oh, yeah, what's all that? So we start with 24 of Matthew 17. When they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the 2 drachma tax went up to Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the tax?" He said, "Yes." And when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first. He said, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others?" And when he said, "From others," Jesus said to him, "Well, then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea, cast a hook, take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself." So everybody in this story seems to know what the 2 drachma tax they were talking about. Or it was called the half shekel tax. And he gets a coin with a shekel. So that's 2 tax bills. It comes from the Old Testament. And we don't know this because we don't get this whole thing because we're not Second Temple Jews. So we have to take the long way around and hear the whole story. This comes from Exodus 30:11. Moses said, the Lord said to Moses, "When you take the census of the people of Israel, when you count them, usually for the purpose of going to war, how many soldiers do I have? Then each shall give a ransom for his life to the Lord when you number them, that there be no plague among them when you number them. Each one who is numbered in the census shall give this, half a shekel, according to the shekel of the sanctuary." The shekel is 20 gerahs, and that's going to be on the final. You want to write it down, 20 gerahs. "Half a shekel as an offering to the Lord. Everyone who's numbered in the census from 20 years old upward shall give the Lord's offering." Okay. And this comes up again in 1 Chronicles when David decides to take a census. But he doesn't collect the tax. He just counts everybody. And Nathan comes to him and says, "You are in big trouble, buddy. What do you prefer as your poison? Would you like to have be pursued by your enemies for X amount of time? And or would you prefer a plague? And of course, the prescribed punishment was a plague. So Christ says, well, rather than be in the hands of men, I prefer the hands of God because he's merciful, so I'll take a plague. And a plague is what he gets. And thousands die. So what stops the plague? Well, the angel of death is seen over Jerusalem, ready to drop his sword and get rid of who's left. And then angel is seen to stay his hand by the intervention of God. He happens to be standing over a big rock called the threshing floor of Ornan. And that's where the plague is stayed. And David is so impressed by this, he goes, he builds this big sacrifice on the rock, burnt sacrifice. And that becomes Mount Moriah, which becomes the rock under the Dome of the Rock. And that's where all of this gets started, is the redemption and the failure to redeem, that God intervenes miraculously and through a sacrifice to take the place of the punishment that should have occurred. Okay. So the point is that you want to take home, if you're still awake and you can actually hear me, which I know that at least one third of you cannot, the half-shemple temple tax was not an ordinary tax. Or who knows what you hear? I mean, that's the fun part. I mean, you walk away and you've heard something. I'd love to know what it was. I mean, but you certainly didn't hear me. Anyway, the half-shemple tax was not an ordinary tax. It was an allegory about the redemption of souls. So, and it continued to be collected up into the Second Temple period and the time of Herod and beyond. The reason was that the Romans were collecting it from the Jews. And the Romans even appointed an official with the title Procurator ad Capitularia Judaeorum, which is the officer of the Jewish tax lists. So the Roman emperors were very interested in this tax. They loved to collect taxes. And it was supposed to be for the upkeep of the temple, but we can imagine that some of it probably got, you know, repurposed. So Domitian was so interested in it that he caused the names of those that lived the Jewish life without paying the tax, or those who sought to keep their Jewish origin secret to avoid paying the tax, to be reported to him. Then one Roman emperor actually struck a special coin for that purpose, and it says what it was for. It's the Jewish temple tax. In fact, the emperors kept on collecting it after they destroyed the temple in 70 AD. And I haven't read this anywhere, but I thought, maybe Caesar Augustus collecting the temple tax and creating a Jewish tax list is where we get Joseph coming to Bethlehem to be taxed. He's got to check in with the temple tax collector. And I've heard some people say, well, there's no evidence that he ever collected a tax. Well, yes, there is. He collected the temple tax. And Jews had to show up and identify themselves as Jews. So the story about Joseph going to Bethlehem actually makes perfect sense. So we can guess, this is probably what Matthew was doing when Christ shows up at his tax collector booth and calls him as a disciple. And we can also probably guess that Matthew was present when some other tax collectors asked Peter a question about law and taxes because of the detail with which Matthew paints this scene. It says, when they came to, verses 24, when they came to Capernaum, collectors of the two drachma tax went up to Peter and said, does your teacher not pay the tax? And Peter said, yes. So, which I guess is a double negative, but anyway. Why do you suppose the tax collectors asked Peter the fisherman a tax question and didn't ask Christ himself and didn't ask Matthew the tax collector, who they probably knew? So the Pharisees didn't want an erudite answer by a professional. They wanted to paint Christ into a corner by baiting him to make an incriminating, for baiting his disciple to make an incriminating statement about taxes or government. So as usual, Pharisees wanted to trap Jesus and saying something they could use as a stick to beat him with. So if Christ says, pay the tax, he's pandering to the hated Roman authorities. If he says, don't pay the tax, he's a tax cheat. He's in rebellion. He's a sovereign citizen. What do they call these guys that tell everybody not to pay taxes? The procurator of the Jewish tax list is going to come after him. But Jesus, as usual, he dodges their little shots. And the temple, because of temple tax, he knows he is this is a discipling opportunity. The temple tax is not about revenue. It's not about taxes. It's not about Roman occupation. It's about redemption. So according to the law of Moses, the temple tax is a ransom for their lives, no matter who collects it. So verse 25, Peter, when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him, Peter, first, saying, what do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tax? From their sons or from others? And when he said, from others, Jesus said to him, then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the first fish you find and take the tax money out of his mouth for both of us. So why do you think Jesus has Peter take the money from the mouth of the fish? Is this an allusion to Jonah? I don't know. This one escapes me. But this is God's provision on the mark. Anybody familiar with Rees Howell's The Intercessor? It's a great book. Rees Howell's Intercessor talks about the discipling of Rees Howell's. Was this Englishman who became famous, establishing orphanages and facilities and praying through the major battles of the Second World War at the Bible College of Wales. And one of the things that happened to him as a young man was being directed of God, according to his understanding, to go to such and such a city when he had no money at all. So he would go get in line in the train station and wait. He had nothing in his pockets. And the line would get shorter and shorter, and he'd come to the end. And he talked about walking up to the cage. Where would you like to go, sir? I'm going to, and he didn't have any money. And suddenly someone taps him on the shoulder and hands him some money. That's called God's provision on the mark. So he gets, here is God's provision on the mark. Time to pay the tax for both of them. Go find a fish. I like it. Okay. So, one level, Christ is making a trifle of paying the tax. Not to give offense to them, as if they mattered. So the Romans collecting tax from the Jews was supposedly to support the Jewish temple, but probably Caesar's just taking a big cut. Rome was really in on it, and he was very interested in it. But Romans who weren't Jews didn't have to pay the tax. So at one level, this is what Christ is talking about when he asked Peter about kings not collecting taxes from their sons, because the Romans are the sons who get off free. But Romans collecting tax from Jews wasn't the real issue for Christ. See, Christ miraculously pays both for himself and for Peter to make a bigger point about redemption, that Christ is the Redeemer of Israel. He does this by paying the tax for himself, and he pays it for somebody else. He sets the sons of Israel free. Pharisee tax collectors weren't around to see Peter the fisherman find a coin to pay the temple tax for two people from the mouth of a fish. So that miracle was just for the disciples' benefit. It wasn't for the Romans' benefit or anybody else. He's discipling. So that's when Christ asked Peter, what do you think? And this is part of how Christ disciples people. He engages their mind. What do you think? So when he disciples his disciples, Christ doesn't just tell them what to do or what not to do. He asks reflective questions. Like, what do you think? What do you want me to do? That's my favorite. And someone walks up to him and says, what do you want me to do? Great stuff. So this is an example for us of how we ought to be discipling others. Only Matthew gives us this detail. He shows up five places in his gospel. So he thought about this a lot. So minds matter to Christ. Your mind matters to Christ. When we disciple others after Christ's example, we must engage people's minds, because that's what he did. And I think about Aquinas and the Scholastics in the 1100s and the 1200s. You know, while the rest of Europe is engaging in warfare in the Crusades against the Arabs and whoever else was in Jerusalem, Aquinas and the Scholastics were developing and founding the modern university. And they were training themselves to engage the minds of Jews and Arab Muslims who were already way ahead of them in thinking about science and the teachings of Plato and Aristotle. And that's the beginning of the modern university. And it may seem unrecognizable now, but it was about people, young believers in fellowship, going, what is going on? The world's leaving, the intellectual world is left without us. We need to go engage these people and not just engage them with the sword, but engage their minds, which is clearly God's work. And we have this wonderful gift of common grace, which is all of the universities of the world. But this is where they started. Okay. I'm about to go stale, but here I'll go a little ways. Why did Christ ask Peter what he thought and not Matthew? So I picture Matthew. He's jumping up and down in the back row. I know, ask me, I know. It's the Romans, it's Moses, it's this, it's that. But Matthew, the tax expert, doesn't get to answer. Peter, the fisherman, gets to answer. Because the answer Christ wanted to bring out was not about taxes or government. It was about teaching the redemptive work of Messiah. Because Christ, the Redeemer and Creator, made a vending machine fish that paid the redemption price for both of them. And it had to do with managing the disciples' expectations of Messiah. As you remember, they're disturbed, they're distressed. Because redemption is what the Messiah is all about. And Christ wanted them to understand that redemption is what the whole trip to Jerusalem and all that mess was going to be about. And it just wasn't going to look like what they expected it to look like. So you go to the next chapter back, and Christ asks his disciples, who do you say that I am? This is just before this visit to Capernaum. Simon Peter says, you're the Messiah, Son of the living God. He gets it. Jesus replies, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this is not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father who is in heaven. And verse 21, from that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day raised to life. And what does Peter say about that? He took him aside and began to rebuke him. Never, Lord, this shall never happen to you. It's a crisis of expectations. And Jesus turns to Peter and says, get behind me. You're a stumbling block. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but human concerns. And he says, truly I tell you, some of you who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And at that he's talking about senior moment. Moses and Elijah show up with, you know what I'm talking about. Okay. So this is, thank you, transfiguration. This is Christ managing Peter's and the other disciples' expectations about Messiah and our own expectations about Messiah. So what does it truly mean to be able to see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom? The disciples would have known from Psalms that the Messiah is seated at the right hand of the Father with all things under his feet. And Peter had just been rebuked by Christ over failed expectations. Now Christ is redeeming Peter's embarrassment by offering him something very different and better that none of them were ready to see. So maybe that's why he didn't ask Matthew the question. But even after everything Christ said to them, the disciples still didn't get any closer to working out their expectations of Messiah until after the resurrection. We'll go to Luke 24, 3 days after the crucifixion. Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days? What things? He sees Jesus and will recognize him. He's having fun with him. He has a sense of humor. What about Jesus of Nazareth? They replied. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. So the disciples didn't connect the dots back to the fish with a temple tax coin in its mouth, and back to David, and back to all these things that happened with that silly old coin. It stands for the redemption of Israel. So it was that hard for them. And they were steeped in the Old Testament prophecy. What do you think? So what does it truly mean to be able to see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom? Is it any easier for us than for them, even though we think we know the end of the movie? And we think we know how it all turns out? So this is a problem that you and I both have with Christ. What part of all do you not understand? We can't see what all authority or all things given over to Christ at the right hand of the Father looks like in a broken, rebellious world. We are no different than Second Temple Jews. Christ died, he's resurrected, the church was established and spread, but it still looks like the bad guys are in charge. But Christ's kingdom has come to us, he said it did, and it doesn't look like we expect it to look. But that is the reality on all levels, and any problem is not with Christ's kingdom, it is with our expectations. So Christ has given us the Holy Spirit to rightly manage our expectations and show us what's really going on, to see the Son of Man actually in his kingdom. Christ is indeed king in the present moment and forever. He's not going to be king. He is king. We're not waiting for him to become king. He's king. Christ is king. The Great Commission. 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. Then Jesus came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you, and surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age." So how are you managing your expectations of Messiah? So you look again, verse 17, when they saw him, of Matthew 28, when they saw him, they worshiped him, the resurrected Christ. But some doubted the resurrected Christ. Then Jesus came to them, all of them, doubters and worshipers, and he says, "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples." So Jesus said that to the worshipers, but he also said it to the doubters. All authority has been given. So what do you think? Is he living up to your expectations? Are you worshiping him? Or is he not living up to your expectations? You're doubting. Well, Christ says the same thing to both of you. What do you think of that? Worshipers and doubters. All right, well, I'm overripe. I was going to tell you another story, but you're going to miss it. So see you next week. Bye.